Hello and welcome back to the Nightlamp Podcast. I'm Stefan Friedrich.
And hello, I'm Adela Holmes, Stefan's podcast buddy.
Well, maybe I'm your podcast buddy.
Well, maybe you are.
Well, it's been a little while since our last episode. I think it's been rather difficult for us to be in the same studio because we've been at opposite ends of the world, as always.
Well, at least at the country, Stefan.
No. I want to think big. I want to think big.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's really the country. but we've been up and down the east coast of Australia doing training at a number of different locations.
Mostly training. Yes. Facilitating a little bit of reflective practice and some consults, but lots and lots and lots of training lately. Mm. We've been doing mostly what we do, I guess, is training people in the use of trauma-informed principles and theory and practice. It's been really, really interesting.
It has been interesting, and one of the things, and I think I mentioned this in one of our other podcasts, one of the things that often comes up in the training is that people say, oh, wow, I never really quite understood the connection between traumatic events, what kids do, and how to actually respond to it. And I find it really pleasing if somebody, if people are saying that to me at the end of a training session, that tells me that people have really joined the dots. As anyone who listens to these podcasts know, I'm a great person for trying to join dots and help people to make sense of things and respond to them in a different way than perhaps they usually have.
And I think usually, I know the way that you join the dots is to clarify, firstly to clarify a few things. And I think that there's a little bit of haziness around people's understanding of what trauma is, firstly, and what complex trauma is. And also then to extend that, a little bit of haziness behind what therapeutic care is.
Yes, because one of the issues that seems to come out quite commonly in training is that people understand that abuse and neglect constitute a type of trauma, but sometimes the links between that and how they then later behave and some of the things that they do are not as clear as they need to be if we're going to actually develop trauma-informed responses.
What I get sometimes is a trauma that people think, they often think that a trauma-informed response or a response is in therapeutic care or therapeutic practice just means letting kids get away with stuff.
Oh, yes, I'm no stranger to that.
Means, that means we're just letting them get away with stuff, letting them get away with everything. And so what's missing there is an understanding about what you're actually doing, which is not letting them get away with stuff.
Not at all.
In fact, actually, it has nothing to do with
the
that.
Complete opposite. but it is, it requires, in order to be able to understand that that's not so, it requires a detailed knowledge of trauma, complex trauma, or developmental trauma, as I like prefer to call it, and what, in what ways it impacts on a person's functioning, and therefore how they see the world, and therefore what they do in response to things that happen in that world. And there's some very discrete steps of understanding in that, which, without which it's almost impossible to understand what a trauma-informed therapeutic response is.
And I think, firstly, you just named it. I mean, you said you prefer to say developmental trauma rather than complex trauma.
Yes.
And I know why, because I often hear people mistake complex trauma for classic or single event trauma, as we call it.
That's right.
Where they think that, oh, it's just really complex.
Yes.
Like when a traumatic thing happens to an adult and leads to other lots of really traumatic things and it's really complicated, they believe that that is complex trauma. But in the sense of its definition, as we have come to know it, complex trauma is synonymous with developmental trauma.
Yes.
And it begins in early childhood.
Or in infancy. Or in utero.
Is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. In utero sometimes. I mean, I particularly like Bruce Perry's definition and distinction where he talks about how a single episode trauma, or even multiples of a single episode trauma, in adult life, when the brain is fully developed and when neural pathways are more or less laid down, although obviously the brain changes all the time, but the impact of those traumatic events is on an already organised brain, an already developed brain, whereas the impact of developmental trauma actually provides the organising environment for the brain's development, which is a very different thing. And it's that distinction that I think is really important in terms of understanding why developmental trauma or complex trauma, they're interchangeable terms, why it has the profound impact that it does.
I must say, in our travels recently, when I say recently, in the last couple of years, I've seen in lots of different programs, whether it's residential care, you know, or foster care, or loads of other different outreach programs and family support, that I've actually seen a little bit of a slide away from understanding developmental trauma in that way. And in fact, I've seen that it might just be my experience. I don't have the data to back it up, but I've seen a little bit of a decrease in the use of trauma, the use of the language of understanding trauma. People use it flippantly, or they use the term therapeutic care flippantly. They say, oh, well, this is a therapeutic program. And I say, well, what's therapeutic about it? What makes it a therapeutic program? Because therapeutic, for me, it comes from therapy, meaning healing, meaning something's getting better. And so a therapeutic care program has to be more than, as well as, but more than a nice place.
Yeah.
It has to be more than that.
Good care. Yes.
It has to be much more than good care. And there's been a little bit of a mistake in terms that people think that a therapeutic care program is just one that's good, whereas they should all be good. But a therapeutic care program should actually be specifically facilitating the healing of someone who's psychologically wounded or wounded emotionally.
Indeed. And the difficulty in terms of people's struggle with grasping that is that the concepts involved are actually quite complex. And they really need to be fully taught and fully grasped and understood before that level of care can actually be provided in any setting. I mean, Stefan, you'll remember, of course, where the circumstances under which we first met.
Yes, about 8 years ago.
Yes, yeah. In 2007. When I was managing Hurstbridge Farm, which was the Victorian government's flagship model of therapeutic residential care.
Yes.
And you applied to be the assistant manager.
That's right. And you loved my interview.
I did. And you got the job.
I went for funny. I told some jokes.
Not all funny. But you got the job, and then we worked together at Hurstbridge for about 2.5 years. Yeah.
But, like, in that time, like, you know, Hurstbridge was a flagship program.
Yes,
there was
a lot
of talk about it.
Yep.
If you remember, we had visitors from every other state in Australia.
Indeed.
From everywhere, you know, from ACT, from Perth, from
Sydney.
From Brisbane, from everywhere.
Yep.
To look at what we were doing there.
Yep.
And, in fact, the language and understanding of developmental trauma really went right through all sorts of documents, even bureaucratic documents.
Indeed.
Because even Victoria's newest legislation,
yes.
Or acts, you know, for children, young people, family, children, families, young people.
That was the language that was being...
It used the language at the time.
Imbued in
so,
the Act, yes.
So it, the language was even there. Mm. Now, is it just me, or since that time, where you know, you had done before Hurstbridge, you had been developing, the, you know, you developed the Circle Therapeutic Foster Care Program. I had a lot to do with that.
Not the whole program there. Uh-huh. You're talking me up a bit more than I deserve, uh-huh. but I was working at Take Two in the leadership group of Take Two at the time, and it was my role to develop the role of the clinician
for
services that wanted to partner with Take Two.
But at the time, that there was specifically about understanding
Absolutely, and developing therapeutic foster care along trauma-informed lines as well. And, of course, the whole drive towards the development of Hurstbridge and prior to that the development of Take Two had come out of a seminal document that was written and published in 1999 called When Care Is Not Enough. Mm-hmm. And that was written at the request of the Department of Human Services, and it was a study that had been undertaken in terms of how best to provide care and care and other involvements that were of a therapeutic nature, like therapy, to children who were clients of child protection, because it had been seen very clearly that services that were in existence that were more generic missed the mark. They really didn't provide what was required for children. That was in terms of therapy. And that the care situations that young people were finding themselves in were also missing the mark in a number of different ways. And because that was having an impact on the development of or the trajectory of children who'd come into care, the Children's Court magistrates had become quite upset, and it was their approaches to the head office of DHS which led to the work that was undertaken and then reported in When Care Is Not Enough. So this all came out of some real recognition that care was not enough.
Yep.
Which goes back to the point that you made just before about how important it is to provide a healing type of care.
Because, of course, I imagine the document meant good care is not enough.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And out of that document eventually flowed the inception of Take Two as an intensive therapeutic service and the development of what later became Hurstbridge Farm Therapeutic Care Program.
I noticed a few years on, probably a couple of years ago, I noticed as people I spoke to in all different areas, you know, parts of the field, at all different levels, from workers on the ground, carers on the ground, through to managers, would say things to me like, well, it's a bit of a buzzword, isn't it? Mm. You know, trauma and therapeutic and all that. Mm. And it was almost a feeling like, well, it'll come and go, kind of like a fad. Mm. Like putting therapeutic care into the same category as, you know, Pac-Man and the Rubik's Cube. You know, something that'll come and go. Mm. And for me, I saw, and this is my own, I guess, anecdotal evidence, that I began to sense a little bit of watering down of what the theory actually tells us to do in practice and in policy, in all areas. Mm. And I think now, am I wrong, Adela, in saying that I'm seeing less of the language use and less of the application of the theory, even though we've had an increase in the numbers of specifically therapeutic care programs since that time?
I don't think you are wrong, because I think I'm seeing the same thing. And I find it, having put so much care and thought and passion into the development and the writing of models, having been involved both in the writing of Take Two and Hurstbridge Farm practice models, I find it really dismaying that that does seem to be the case.
I often wonder why. Like, I know that, you know, working with, engaging in trauma and engaging yourself and being at the coalface of children's pain is very difficult.
It actually can
lead to a feeling of despair. Even though we can be doing good work, it can sometimes, if it's not addressed, it can feel not good. And I'm wondering if that plays into it. Because, you know, as you and I, you know, we've been using a lot of data, so we can show people that we're working with, here's the data, we know that these children are getting better. It may not be feeling good right now for us.
Look, that's true, and you mentioned the word data, and I think it's very important also that we remember that Verso Consulting conducted a very extensive formal evaluation of Hurstbridge Farm and 12 other pilots, all of which were using effectively the same practice model.
And it's publicly available.
It's on the DHS website.
I would say to listeners out there, I'd say
if you're interested, do
a Google search on the Verso evaluation of therapeutic care programs in Victoria, something like that, and you'll find it. You'll be able to download a PDF report, and it is quite fascinating and very telling on the effectiveness of this approach.
Indeed. And that was actually completed in 2011, although not released until the following year. But if we're talking about data, and the data is too huge to go into in a podcast, but suffice it to say that that model of practice was proved to provide significant improvements in children's quality of life and functioning across all domains of their lives.
And we know it was the model that did that because you and I have used the same types of measures and we've been able to actually duplicate those same results
in other settings
with other programs, with some of our other programs Queensland and other in other areas.
So that's absolutely right. I left Hurstbridge in 2009, but since then, in a variety of different roles, have applied the same principles of practice to a number of either individually tailored settings or care settings with a number of children
in. We still do here.
Still get exactly the same level of result. So I do find it incredibly dismaying when I see what I do consider to be a dilution of the knowledge that was actually gained throughout years of input. There was a working group that applied hours and hours of thought to what the best model was. In my role at Take Two, it fell to me to write a practice model for the to-be-formed flagship model. I read extensively about programs that had existed in the UK for 70 years, had existed in the United States for 30 or 40 years. These were all successful models that used similar practice approaches that were grounded in understandings of developmental trauma and its impact on neural development and attachment capacity and internal working model and a child's template for understanding the world. All these programs had in common a particular approach upon which the Hurstbridge model was founded. And we know that these other programs in other countries have existed for years and continuously provided the same input to very good effect for children. So I guess I find it really dismaying when for a very short period of time we glimpsed that model here in this country, but it seems to me a bit at the moment like the string on a balloon. that's floated away, and somehow we're trying to grab onto it, but something is happening and something is missing.
Well, if we've, you know, in my view, if we really, as a sector, want to make a difference, because we do, you know, we talked earlier about this idea that, you know, in many of my workshops, I often ask people to remember their very first interview for the first job that they ever applied for in the welfare field. And I often ask them, when you are asked, what brings you, what makes you apply for this position? Most people, and I ask them to say, what did you say? Right? Most people actually say something along the lines of, I wanted to give back, I want to make a difference. Now, here we have a way that we have evidence to show that you can make a difference in this way. And it's so exciting. And I just think that, you know, here we have an opportunity for us all, everyone who works in any helping profession, to actually make a difference, to do what you set out to do in the beginning.
Exactly. And it works. And it works for two reasons. And when you say it's based on evidence, it's evidenced at two levels, if you like. Because there is evidence to show what happens in the brain when children experience abuse and neglect. So again, we're not talking about, oh, abuse and neglect have an emotional impact on a child. I believe that this happens, or I believe that that happens. As anyone will know who's been to Bruce Perry's training, he often shows in that training a slide with two brains. One is of a healthy three-year-old who has had optimal developmental experiences, and it is of a normal size. And beside it is the brain of a three-year-old who has severely compromised development as a result of severe neglect. That brain is smaller, not only in its overall size, but in terms of various different elements of the brain's function.
Yeah, it's quite astounding.
They're different shape. We could put that slide on our website for anyone who's not familiar with it. So we're not dealing with an ideology here. We're not dealing with an, I believe this to be the case.
No.
This is evidence.
Yes, yes.
So that's evidence. And then the approach that was developed in terms of working with children who are struggling with those impacts was firstly trialled at Hurstbridge after only 12 months because we were getting very promising results. 12 more pilots were put out to tender, and the essential design elements for which agencies had to include those in the design of their potential pilots were drawn from the practice model at Hurstbridge. That is what was evaluated. So there's a second tier of evidence because the evaluation occurred over 2 years and over those 2 years, those children, young people, showed significant improvement.
So we have evidence for what happens to a person when they do experience trauma in infancy, and we have evidence to show what happens to those same people when carers respond in a therapeutic way, which is informed by this theory.
By the knowledge of what has happened. That's
pretty
compelling for me.
And we've shown the evidence. We know we can make a difference. We know that there is a chronic elevated arousal baseline. We know we know what we need to do to lower that baseline. And if you lower a person's arousal baseline, that is the difference between being able to attend school or a job or not, being able to maintain a relationship or not. You know, that's a big difference to someone's life. That's making a difference. If you can, if we can facilitate insight through therapeutic conversations, you know, that have a structure in themselves, we can facilitate insight using those conversations in very simple ways that a person can understand themselves and slowly change their internal working model to be able to actually tolerate success, good things in their lives, and good people and good care. I mean, that's a massive difference. That is making a difference
that,
in my opinion.
That is making a difference. and that's, I think, one of the... I'm glad you raised that, because for me, there are two essential elements of providing real therapeutic care. One is what I call being the trauma detective.
Yeah.
So you look at a piece of any piece of behaviour that a child is demonstrating. Often, children who've experienced trauma will be acting in a way that is overreactive to the circumstance in which they find themselves. We know that the reason that for that is that they become chronically elevated, and we also know that from that base of chronic elevation, because trauma can be has the capacity to be triggered by the presence in present time of anything that was present at the time of the trauma. For a child who has experienced developmental trauma, which is effectively trauma within the warp and the weft of their life, anything can be a trigger. So if you see a child who's been traumatized in acting in present time in a way that makes no sense, always remember, it does make sense. It makes sense somewhere. It makes sense in some way. It just doesn't make sense looking at the outside of it.
But there's a vulnerability.
On the inside of it, it will make sense. It could be the smell of food. It could be the look in somebody's eyes. It could be the colour red. It could be anything that is the trigger.
So the mistake is that a child becomes triggered, acts in a violent way or extremely inappropriate way, whatever it might be. They have no control over it because their fight or flight or freeze response has been activated.
Post-traumatic stress disorder response. Yeah.
And then they're doing something for which they've got no control over that. And then we're going to endow them responsibility for that and say, well, now I have to impose a consequence for your behaviour so you can learn. Now, unfortunately, Skinner's rat can't help us with this one. Operant conditioning does not work here, right? But that's maybe a topic for another day.
It probably is.
That we have some vulnerabilities, and we have vulnerabilities in people's internal working model. They are unable to really be able to identify who's safe and who is not. People take advantage of that. People who are, adults who are predators will.
Absolutely.
Acting in predatory ways will take advantage of that.
They will take advantage of that,
I wonder to what extent, for example, the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Sexual Abuse in Care, or to any abuse in care, to what extent they have taken into account the knowledge that is available on developmental trauma.
Yes, well, I recently had some calls to look into some of the documentation.
Ah, yes, last week you were.
I was a bit dismayed, I must say, that there didn't seem to have been a representation that fully articulated that.
Well, they do talk about the
They talk about
and
trauma.
Yes.
And they didn't, in the documentation that I read, and I'm still trawling through it because I don't want to say things that aren't so, but in what I've read so far, I couldn't see a representation of how developmental trauma might render someone prone to reenact their own trauma of sexual abuse by abusing others. Or any of the complexities around that. I did not see evidence of that, but I'm still reading. So we might have to make that the topic of
podcast. That the Royal Commission, I think, could make use of in terms of understanding trauma.
Absolutely.
And children's vulnerabilities, the way that they're cared for, and it's especially to be able... we did, a whole lot of training last year and also a lot of training on behalf of the Royal Commission and the Lighthouse Institute on behalf of the Royal Commission on understanding trauma-informed practice.
Yes.
So, you know, in that way, they are on it. But is it really, is the language really
woven,
embedded and woven through everything? Well, probably not.
Yeah.
And we're, it's probably decreased a little bit right throughout the whole sector.
Yes, particularly through the out-of-home care sector, which is, of course, where it's most needed.
So I guess the question is, and where's trauma gone? Where has an understanding of trauma gone?
Yeah, and certainly there has been no alteration in the broader field that would suggest that the relevance of the theory that we hear about and are trained in by proponents of trauma-informed practice like Bruce Perry.
Well, there's been no superseding new
theory.
There's
been no superseding new theory, no.
So
from that point of view, trauma hasn't gone anywhere. But from a practical perspective, I feel that it's not quite as front and centre as it was, having been part, a very central part of those heady days where a lot of the development of services was occurring in the early to mid-2000s.
Yeah.
There has been some kind of dilution around the understandings of what it's all about.
Well, let's be...
let's lead the charge.
Let's be solution-focused. Yeah. What are we going to do?
I mean, let's find trauma again.
I would implore listeners out there, let's bring that focus back on trauma. And I think, you know, we can begin to bring it back. I guess just talking about it. You know, here we go.
Well,
we're talking about it
we're
today.
We're talking about
that
it today.
Helped. We're talking about language.
Hopefully people will be listening to us who are working in the out-of-home care sector. I'm sure they do, because that's the area that we really focus on in our work and in our training.
Well, recently we've actually expanded into other areas because, as we know, this is not only, it's not about working with children, although we have worked with many, many children and lots of people who care for them. It's about childhood trauma, which is why we've worked in prisons, why we work in the broader sense for our legal systems, in adult homelessness. And I think that we can come to know that a trajectory in the criminal system, that homelessness, these are all attributable effects of childhood trauma. Yeah.
And I think we talked about this in an earlier podcast.
Yeah.
That often, if we are looking at all of those other manifestations of childhood trauma, the long-term manifestations of unresolved and untreated childhood trauma, what we're actually looking at is effects, not causes, not issues in themselves, because the cause is trauma. The effect is homelessness or
Absolutely.
Substance abuse.
Absolutely.
So childhood trauma that is unresolved sits at the base of all these other societal ills. And how? And I know that the Verso evaluation report included in it a substantial part on cost-benefit analysis in terms of those children's intrusion into other parts
long-term
of the system.
Long-term cost-effectiveness.
Yeah. But when you look at the potential impact, positive impact, on early healing of trauma, on the life trajectory through all those other systems, for me, it seems clear.
It's a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer.
Because it's usually we're thinking short-term costs. We're thinking, oh, this is an expensive program. Mm. But actually, when you look at the economic benefits for a person over a life, not even a lifetime, over the next 10 years.
That's right.
And can I tell you what my moment of the month was? I had an experience yesterday which was very touching, and I must say I was emotionally very touched. I was in a workshop. There were people present from the adult homelessness sector, so lots of case managers and workers. They'll introduce themselves. They talked about where they were from and what they did. And then one man in that group who absolutely made my day. And if you're listening, thank you so much. And when it got to him, he said, well, I don't work in this system. I've just been in the system all my life. And at the end of the day, you know, I ran the workshop as I usually do. But at the end of the day, he waited till everyone had gone and he thanked me for the day and for the fact that the workshop had made clear to him so much about his own life and about the people who had worked with him and, you know, the effect of the work on them. And it was enlightening, not only for him, but it, you know, it was for me too, because I saw how an understanding of trauma could help you, not only when you're 10 or 15, but, you know, when you're 50.
Indeed. Well,
it was really, really very touching and a rewarding moment for me.
I've had similar experiences and was speaking to a family support program quite some years ago now, in 2010, about what we'd been doing in the out-of-home care system in Victoria, using trauma-informed understandings. And the particular program that was having its annual conference is a program that utilises a model where past participants, after they've graduated, come back to work as helpers. With new participants. And one of the women who was a past participant who is now working came up to me after I delivered my presentation and she said to me, you've just talked about my life and what a pity you weren't there when I was a child. And it's certainly something special when you get people whose lives are touched in that way.
Yeah.
But over the years of working in a trauma-informed way, we have seen many people whose lives, children, whose lives were turned around as a result of trauma-informed practice. And for that reason, if no other, I hope people are able to manage to grab hold of that balloon string soon, because we can't let it go.
No.
We cannot let it go.
We need to grab a hold of it and then tie it down.
We do, because for children's lives, we can't let it go.
Well, that was quite a big conversation. That was a good conversation.
Well, it was a good conversation. You know, as is so often the case, Stefan, these are things that you and I have been thinking about and stewing on, you know. And this is a very cathartic opportunity to share some of these thoughts and hopefully gird people for action, because it is really important that we grab hold of some of these understandings again. They're right there. They're two steps away.
Absolutely. If you're out there and you're listening, you can do something simply by just understanding it. Read about it, talk about it, bring it back into your workplace. If it was there and it's no longer there, bring it back. Yes, we need to talk to the funding bodies and ensure that they are providing what needs to be provided, but it's also cultural. It's also about us doing the things that we can do that don't cost us anything. You know, we don't have to buy in a culture. We can actually do it ourselves. We can develop it ourselves. Well, thank you very much, Adela.
Yes, thanks, Stefan, for a very spirited conversation, as always. And let's hope we've put it out there and we can revitalise this move.
Absolutely. For listeners out there, if you'd like to know more, please get in touch with us through our website, nightlamp.org, or jump on our Facebook. Look up Nightlamp on Facebook, and you can make comment on you know, through our Facebook page, make comment or ask questions or begin conversations with us and other people.
Or email us or ring us.
Yeah. All of the above. And catch you again soon.
Bye-bye.